But online with us right now is none other than Terry Crawford Brown, who's a well-known author, activist, anti-arms activist. He also chaired the South African affiliate of Economists Allied for Arms Reduction. He's written many books, amongst them being Eye on the Diamonds, Eye on the Money, and he's played a very important role in bringing politicians to account and raising alarm about the arms deal in South Africa so many years ago. Pleasure to welcome Terry to the show this evening. Terry, good evening, and thank you so much for joining us here on Under the Radar.
Good evening. Thank you very much. Wow. Thank you.
Well, hopefully that little chuckle of yours, Terry, sets the scene, or you know, just breaks the ice a bit for what is a very important discussion. And when we talk about the military-industrial complex, I don't think you know, just enough people know exactly what is this about and why we should you know, be prioritizing a discussion about the military-industrial complex. I just want to quote, obviously, one of the most famous lines on the military-industrial complex coming from the former U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower, who said in 1961, this was at the end of his term, he says that a vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. But then he says the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, and even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So it is. So is the very structure of society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist, and we must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Now, we might agree or not agree with, you know, the entire context in which he said it or every bit of his sentiments, but obviously that's an important historical statement regarding the military-industrial complex. Just break it down for us. What is the military-industrial complex that we're going to be discussing in a bit more detail this evening, Terry?
Thank you very much for reading that, because it's a very important statement made in 1960 by President Eisenhower when he was leaving office, warning about the consequences of an arms industry out of control. And sadly, it has deteriorated hugely since 1960. We're now talking about a war business, organized crime out of control, in control of governments such as the U.S. government, the British government, the German government, the Saudi government, and even our government. It's a hugely problematic problem. The arms industry is estimated to be responsible for about 45% of world corruption. So it's something that really needs to be addressed, because they fleece the taxpayers in all countries, both in the States and in South Africa, as we know with the arms deal here. So thank you for citing that. It was 1960, so it's a long time ago, but nonetheless he warned what the consequences would be of allowing the arms industry out of control.
Why particularly, Terry, the military-industrial complex, just the choice of words there?
Well, it's the military, but it's also the companies that provide the weapons. But what was also part of Eisenhower's draft in that was congressional, which he was persuaded not to include the word congressional, military-industrial congressional complex, and the U.S. Congress is very much part of the problem. so that the war business has the U.S. Congress under control. So they cite fear, oh, the Russians are going to attack, the Chinese are going to attack. You know, it's a dangerous world out there. We need to spend more money on weapons. And it is now out of control. It's hugely corrupt. And hence we see the consequences with here President Trump.
Yes, absolutely. If we go to the specific players within now, you know, military, the military sphere, the political sphere, the industrial sphere, if you were to, you know, single out particular names, is there a kind of monopoly over this entire complex?
Yes. I mean, obviously the U.S. is dominant in the world, but the British and the Germans are also very much part of it as well. But it is the U.S. military-industrial complex that negotiated with Saudi Arabia in 1973 over Saudi oil that actually funds U.S. military interventions around the world. So there are now an estimated 1,000 U.S. military bases surrounding Russia, surrounding China, aimed at U.S. supremacy around the world. So they intervene where they wish, but is actually paid for by the rest of the world because Saudi oil and OPEC oil is priced in U.S. dollars, which gives the U.S. an extraordinary advantage. The rest of the world is paying for U.S. militarism.
When we talk about the military-industrial complex, would this be an accurate observation? People have also made it, for instance, Terry, with regard to the pharmaceutical companies, saying that in some instances, or with regard to some companies, people, you know, invent medicines before you know, a sickness is invented. So it's actually, you know, a company, you know, particular companies would invent a product and thereafter find a particular condition or create a particular condition so that that product will be marketed as the solution to that particular product. Now, obviously, that's not your forte, but I'm talking, giving that as an example, mm-hmm. with regard to you know, the military-industrial complex. Is it that you know, if we want to say prior to this or in history, you know, arms had a more defensive purpose. It would be used, obviously offensive as well, but in many cases, it would people would purchase and manufacture arms to defend nations. Today, the weapons are being manufactured for the purpose of really proliferating wars in our world.
Yes. I mean, as an illustration, the opioid, so-called opioid crisis in the States, where Americans are now over-prescribed medicines and become drug addicted. So the pharmaceutical industry is part and parcel of that problem. But the armaments industry is 10, 20, 100 times worse than the pharmaceutical company. And so they deliberately, the Americans have lost every war since the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, every war they've done. But that actually doesn't concern them too much, as long as they can have another war on someone else's territory. So Iraq, Afghanistan, you name it, let's have another war, because as long as they can sell more weapons and they need a new war every 3 years to get rid of the old stock and try out the new stuff. It is out of control. It really is a war business that is, as I said, organized crime.
So does that then point to a major weakness in terms of how activists or civil society have been perhaps directing their efforts so far, however well-intentioned, which is, you know, directing opposition to politicians or directing opposition to certain ideologies, for instance, that may be seen to be driving conflicts, whereas a far greater amount of time and effort needs to be expended targeting the people who foster such wars, the people who profit from such wars. Is that a missing realization perhaps amongst the activist community?
Well, I think it's, and ironically, if I may say so, I think we in South Africa kind of pioneered the questioning. 100 years ago, before the First World War, there was someone called, ironically, Philip Snowden, a British parliamentarian, who said, we're in the hands of an organization of crooks who simply create all these fears in order to fleece the treasury. Now, until and during the so-called Cold War, no one questioned the right of politicians in the military, the armaments industry, to define what is a national priority or national security. And if you will, in the mid-1990s, with the end of the Cold War, we in South Africa said our priority is poverty alleviation. No one is about to attack us. The Russians are not going to attack us. The Chinese are not going to attack us. We must put all our priority into addressing the legacies of poverty. And that was kind of unheard of, that civil society questioned governments to prioritize other issues of what has become described as human security as opposed to military security. Because up until now, it's all been military security and government knows best.
So, I mean, still, you know, just revolving around that particular question, how do we get people to fully understand, or what would you advise? What's the kind of sources to physically demonstrate to people? Perhaps you can contextualize a particular conflict. Let's take, the war in Iraq, which is kind of has a unanimity around the world as being a totally unjust conflict, although there are many others other conflicts that are equally immoral. But what role did the military industrial complex play in driving that particular conflict?
There were elements in the States in the late 1990s. With the end of the Cold War, the military-industrial complex had to create a new enemy. We always need a new enemy. So communism was no longer an enemy. They had to create a new enemy in Islam. And they were itching for a new war, and 9/11 was a perfect opportunity. There's no evidence that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11. But within days, the Americans were saying, we're going to attack Iraq, and then we're going to attack seven other Arab countries, culminating on an attack on Iran. And that's what they've been doing since 9/11. The lies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction have been exposed. The lies around Libya have been exposed. The lies around Syria are being exposed. The lies around Yemen. And suddenly they're running out of stories. And fortunately, there is now increasing world communication. So these lies are investigated, which I think is why there is increasing demand among civil society to say, hey, governments, you have misled the people, you have lied to the people, we want to hold you to account. Unfortunately, Tony Blair and George Bush have not been held up for war crimes, but that issue continues to be raised. So we're no longer baffled when governments say national security. You know, the Russians are coming.
Another area that you obviously very active in, you've raised your voice consistently on this, obviously would be one of the greatest moral issues of our time, being the Palestinian conflict. Again, how is it in this particular conflict that the Israeli military industrial complex dictates when wars happen, when conflicts happen, and the regularity of such conflict?
Yes, well, I mean, since the 1940s, Israel has been championed by the United States, and President Truman was warned by his advisors, both in the State Department and in the military, that not to get involved, but he was only interested in the Jewish vote in the States. So for the past 70 years, the U.S. has been championing Israel, which has become, as some of my Israeli friends will say, Israel does the dirty work for the United States. It destabilizes, it deliberately destabilizes countries in Africa and Asia because it sells weapons to keep people, for instance, in the Congo, like Kabila, in office. But they then plunder the natural resources in the Congo of cobalt, coltan, copper, diamonds, etc. And those resources then end up through the international banking system into the Israeli economy. So the Americans are very happy to abuse their veto rights at the United Nations Security Council because Israel is doing the dirty work for them.
A staggering statistic you quoted earlier there, Terry, where you said 45% of corruption worldwide is as a result of the military-industrial complex. And here in South Africa, the cardinal sin, and it's literally opened up the doors of corruption, as we still feel today, was the arms deal. It might seem a long time ago, it might seem that, you know, we've dealt with many other elements of corruption after that, and people will think about Inkandla or state capture, and we seem to have those much more fresher in our memory. But how did the arms companies, major arms companies, European arms companies, contribute to a culture of impunity and corruption in South Africa that we still feel today?
Yeah. That 45% estimate, incidentally, comes from Transparency International. What happened in the early 1990s, as we were celebrating our transition from apartheid, was that the European governments, as you remember, all the European politicians were here every other week, saying how much they admired the new democracy in South Africa with the one hand, and they were selling weapons with the other. And so they put massive pressure on our government to buy weapons, and they dressed up with the idea if we spent $30 billion on weapons, warships, and warplanes, we would get $110 billion back in offsets that would create 65,000 jobs. So you could smell the corruption. I mean, it just didn't make sense. And as early as 1998, I got information from ANC whistleblowers that the BAE, British Aerospace, was laundering bribes through two Swedish trade unions to the ANC members of parliament ahead of the 1999 election to support the arms deal. I got confirmation in Sweden, but they said, we can't get any further. So I asked the British government to investigate. Scotland Yard was appointed, and eventually it came back from Scotland Yard. It was not illegal in English law to bribe foreigners, and therefore there was no crime to investigate. Now, roll on to 2010, when TV4 in Sweden revealed that the man in Sweden who actually facilitated those bribes, who was then the international relations officer for one of the Swedish trade unions, he became the Swedish prime minister. He just lost office a couple of months ago, Stefan Löfven. He facilitated those bribes. Now, in Germany, the bribes were actually tax deductible as a useful business expense. So it's 20 years ago where bribes to foreigners, you couldn't bribe within your own country, but bribes to foreigners was fine. Bribes, you always blame the foreigners as corrupt, we are squeaky clean. And the English have been practicing it for 800 years. So we have made progress since then. But corruption is now increasingly recognized as a major problem internationally. It's slow in coming, but the opportunities for holding people accountable are improving. It's now illegal. The law enforcement is still very lax, but at least in law, it is now illegal. So yeah, we are making progress, albeit slowly.
But on the significance of that, is it a bit of an overstretch to say that a culture of corruption was, festered in South Africa or fostered in South Africa as a result of the arms deal which struck so early in our democracy, and that its echoes is still what we have today?
Absolutely. I mean, the British found Joe Madise. Joe Madise was a gangster from the teenage days. And so they found him to do the dirty work. And that's how they operate. They find someone to do the dirty work, and they walk away from the consequences. Former President Zuma is coming to trial the 30th of November. Now, during the People's Tribunal on Economic Crime held at the Constitutional Court in February this year, a former lawyer for Thales or Thompson CSF, as it used to be known, testified how he'd accompanied Zuma to the Elysee Palace in Paris twice for banquets with President Chirac and President Sarkozy. And when the Sarita Commission was appointed, after I took Zuma to Constitutional Court, Zuma telephoned EJ Sukral and said, don't tell the Sarita Commission that the French were paying in 2009. So they find people like Modise or Zuma to do the dirty work, and they walk away from the consequences.
And it's all very depressing at the end of the day, because these kind of military deals would have a direct impact on the kind of budgets that would be available, or the kind of people don't tend to see it in that way, but it has an effect on service delivery. It broadens inequality in South Africa, impact on poverty, etc.
Absolutely, we could address all the major social problems that we face: education, health, housing, jobs creation, etc. If we didn't squander money on weapons. It's a hub, and it's internationally, there's increasing focus. If we reallocated a fraction of what we spend on weapons, on poverty alleviation, we could address these issues quite rapidly.
There's the American companies, the European companies, the Israeli companies, as you mentioned, but the South African company, the state-owned company you've suggested, is also part of this complex and part of the problem in many ways. Since its inception, or since the advent of democracy, how has Denel played a part in making weapons available and promoting conflicts around the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right after, with 2 or 3 months after our transition in 1994, Arms Corps was found selling AK-47s to Yemen and to Croatia, and it created a whole scandal, and the Cameron Commission of Inquiry was appointed by President Mandela. Now, in the meantime, 2 years earlier, Denel had been hived off as the industrial side of Arms Corps. I was appointed by Archbishop Tutu to represent the Anglican Church there, and we said, close this thing down. This is an apartheid-era industry. It is heavily subsidized. It makes no economic sense. It's got a record of corruption, mismanagement, and everything else. Close it down and convert the assets to peaceful purposes. Don't think that exporting weapons is a clever way to operate. It's a heavily subsidized industry in all countries, and those subsidies divert public resources from other priorities. And unfortunately, President Mandela intervened against us and said, oh, we would have a responsible arms industry. Now, in the last 25 years, Denel has gone from one scandal to the next. It's been caught selling weapons to Rwanda, to Saudi Arabia. It tried in Syria and in Colombia, that had a civil war for 45 years, to Algeria, to both India and Pakistan. The National Conventional Arms Control Committee, that is supposed to have oversight over South African arms exports, is a complete fiasco and simply closes its eyes to it. Now, 25 years later, Denel is in financial catastrophe. Close it down. It makes no economic sense. In 2002, I was asked by the BBC defense correspondent to investigate whether Denel was producing landmines in violation of the Ottawa Convention against landmines, and so I met the shop stewards at Swartklip between Khayelitsha and Mitchell's Plain, and they confirmed yes. But they said that the workers at Swartklip don't live very long. They have all kinds of accidents, heart disease, cancer, and so forth. So I brought 16 of their spouses or survivors to testify before Parliament, and Parliament was horrified, but Denel and the Department of Public Enterprises put huge pressure on Parliament not to investigate this further. What I'm coming to is that in September we had the explosion at Denel Rheinmetall at Somerset West. 8 people were killed. Rheinmetall, Denel, have been exporting a factory to Saudi Arabia to produce ammunition, and President Zuma in 2016 actually opened that factory. That factory is obviously producing ammunition for the Saudis to use in Yemen. So we've become complicit in war crimes and what's happening in Yemen. It really is a disgraceful situation that South Africa has become complicit in.
Which leaves us with the question, you continue the fight in many ways. You, as you said, you've made a submission to the Commission of Inquiry recently. But how do we escalate, or how should we escalate the fight against the military-industrial complex, starting with Danel in our own country? How do we put this higher up on the agenda of civil society?
Well, Danel being bankrupt is wanting to raise money, and the question as to whether we would sell Danel to Saudi Arabia. Now, given what's happened with Khashoggi, hopefully that is going to be vetoed, but it's not certain yet. But we need publicly to put pressure on our government to insist under no circumstances is Danel sold to Saudi Arabia or Qatar or to UAE or anyone else. Put it out of business and recover what we can, having wasted 25 years. The people at Danel are the last people. They're essentially well-skilled people. They're the last people who need protected employment. And we should stop kidding ourselves that killing foreigners for profit is a lucrative business. It's not. It's highly subsidized, and we cannot compete against the subsidies the Americans pay for their armaments industry. So we should put Danel out of business, and we need to develop public pressure on our government to say, sorry, we have other priorities, such as education and health, before killing people in Yemen.
Ongoing campaigns or any type of activism that you are aware of people can plug into, Terry?
Well, it's gathering momentum. I mean, in England, in Germany, there's a debate in Congress in the United States this coming week about the role of the United States in supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia. I think there is the possibility, and it's uphill still, but there is the possibility that the tide is turning. But from our own perspective in South Africa, Danel is something we should close down and stop fooling ourselves that this is a lucrative business.
Absolutely. Terry Crawford-Brown, a wide-ranging discussion there, starting from the history of the military-industrial complex, its role in corruption around the world, and particularly bringing it home then to Danel in South Africa and how South Africa is potentially complicit in war crimes in Yemen through Danel's links with Saudi Arabia. That's what we know about. There are many arms sales with other shadowy countries that we don't even know about because of the secrecy with which this trade takes place and the lack of oversight, as he mentioned. So a very broad area and an area that needs sustained and focused activism going forward. More than just saying stop the war, we need to stop those who are the architects of war, and that being the military-industrial complex. Terry, great speaking to you, and keep up the great work. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Shukran. Good night.
Good night. Terry Crawford-Brown speaking to us there from Cape Town about the military-industrial complex, and hopefully we simplified it significantly enough for you to understand at least how to approach this discussion, who are the main players, what are their effects, how are the conflicts that we see around the world actually a result of the deeds of the military-industrial complex more than anything else, and how a lot, worryingly, part of this is happening right on our own doorstep here in South Africa, a country of democracy, a country that's seen as a haven of peace, and many people look to South Africa as a means of settling conflicts peacefully, a means of reconciliation, and yet we're exporting death abroad. And I just think about the town where I live, just in Actonville, in Benoni. You see these tanks literally driving up and down. It's BAE Systems, the company. Just as you enter into Actonville, the tanks going up and down, visiting a garage to fill up some fuel, doing test runs of these tanks. And it was found that these tanks actually took part in the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and were sold to the U.S. military. And it's kind of a difficult feeling to know that we're living in peace and these are our neighbors here, and they're so welcome to drive the tanks up and down on our streets, and yet when they're exported overseas, they become instruments of death for hundreds and thousands of Iraqis and many other people who come at their receiving end. So an area that certainly needs lots and lots of attention. Let's go for a break. After that, we talk about today, the significance of today in history. 100 years ago, World War I came to an end.